Hi, listeners. We've missed you since our last season and are excited to be starting season 3 of this podcast. Sarah and I took a bit of a break from recording because we wrote a book, which we will talk about later in this podcast. For now, welcome back to the conversation. The doctrine of discovery is the current system of laws and policies that justify the removal of land from Indigenous peoples. These laws are rooted in church doctrines that originated in the 15th century.
Together, we will uncover this deep structure of colonization that systematically deprives Indigenous peoples of human rights.
I'm Sherry Hostetler, and I helped start a coalition of Anabaptist people of faith that seek to dismantle the doctrine of discovery. I'm also a Mennonite pastor in San Francisco.
And I'm Sarah Augustine, and I also helped start this coalition. As an activist and scholar, I'm the descendant of the Tewa people and a displaced person. This is the Dismantling the Doctrine of Discovery podcast.
So in this episode, we talk with Patty Krawick, an Anishinaabe and Ukrainian writer from Lac-Seul First Nation. She is the author of the compelling book, Becoming Kin, An Indigenous Call to Unforgetting the Past and Reimagining Our Future, which was released in 2022. She is also the co-host of the Medicine for the Resistance podcast and the co-founder of the Nikanagana Foundation. We're also very honored that Patty wrote a beautiful foreword for our forthcoming book to be published in October, So We and Our Children May Live, Following Jesus in Confronting the Climate Crisis. So welcome, Patty.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm going to fangirl for a couple of minutes about being on Sarah Augustine's podcast. I heard you speak in a webinar, I don't know, like a year ago, maybe. And you said, at some point in the webinar, you said that when the settlers came, they never asked if we had good news for them. And that phrase, I ordered your book while I was listening to you talk because I was like, I have to know more about this. That phrase, I have come back to it again and again and again when I talk with churches, that you never asked us, like, how much different could all this have been if you had asked what good news we had for you? If you had gone looking for the kingdom of God and what God was doing here, instead of just trying to impose it, like how different, like that little question has just so transformative. So I just really appreciate, you know, being able to talk, you know, with somebody who said something that just was really so transformative for me.
Oh, thank you. Oh gosh, I appreciate hearing that. And also, I just feel the same. I was so transfixed by your book. I mean, that's maybe the wrong way to say it, but when I was reading, you know, Becoming Kin, there were moments in it where I was just in tears and so deeply identified with much of what you described. And so what a gift that book is to the whole world. And I also want to say for Indigenous people like me, you know, I just am so thankful that you have shared your experience. And the writing is beautiful. So listeners, please rush out and pick up Becoming Kin. It's just an amazing, amazing book. And I want to get into it a little bit if you're ready and read a short excerpt from Becoming Kin. It's from chapter 6, The Land, Our Ancestor. So to set the context, this was your first return visit home with your dad when you were in your early 20s. You write that you had been out of touch with your dad, and on this trip, he took you to the land of your people. And so here's the excerpt. All these moments were fraught with hope and unrealistic expectations because, like Umfraville itself, which is the town, we are not what we used to be. Our lives have moved in different directions, and our shared memories stop at the same place as the photographs that recorded them. There were people who remembered me, people who remembered stories about me, and in the intervening years, they had periodically wondered what had happened to me. This was not a surprise. I had also leafed through the photo album and wondered what had happened to them. But what was a surprise was the undeniable sensation that the land and water remembered me too. When I read this, Patty, it was really profound for me. I had a similar experience when I traveled home to northern New Mexico in the Chimayo region for the first time. I wonder if you could describe what that was like for you, what it felt like.
Yeah. So my dad, I don't know who left who. The fact is that my mom moved me south to her family, right? So I'm born 4 hours north. So I was born in Thunder Bay. Community is 4 hours north of Thunder Bay, north and west of Thunder Bay. So like it's a 3 day drive, you know, and you're still in Ontario. So you drive for 3 days and like, that's how long it takes to get there. So she moved me south to Niagara where her family lived. I was raised with her family. This was of course long before social media. So I'm not like Facebooking with distant cousins like I am now. I had absolutely no idea how to contact them. Found my dad kind of by accident. I happened to cross somebody who had known him and asked if he had known where my dad was. And this guy says, oh yeah, he's living in North Bay. I was like, what are you talking about? I have been going to North Bay since I was like 9 years old because my stepfather's parents had a cottage in Callander, which is a small town outside of North Bay. And it turned out I probably bought ice cream from my sister without even knowing it. Because my dad had adopted a child in the intervening years. Anyway, so I reconnect with him and we decide to go home. We decide to go home so that I can meet my granny, so that I can, you know, meet cousins and meet family, meet these people that were in that photo album. But at that time, there was no road into Lac Seul. There was no road into the reserve. There is now, like, you know, there has been, you know, for a couple decades, but at the time there was no road. And so we had no way of actually getting to the reserve. So I would often, while we were staying there, go down to the water and look across the water at what he told me, you know, that's reserve land over there. And so it's kind of like this wistful, I'm almost home, you know, feeling of being almost home. I was in the community where he had grown up. We went into Umphreyville, which was like a small milling town, which, you know, it no longer exists. You know, nobody really lives there anymore. So we had gone there. So he was showing me this was, you know, where your granny lived and this was where the school was. And, you know, he was showing me these rundown buildings. And it was so odd that these random cousins just showed up in this area where like nobody lived. Like, why? I don't know if they were there looking for blueberries or what they were doing, but they just kind of randomly showed up. And so like that was itself really powerful, you know, kind of meeting these cousins, exchanging addresses, you know, promising to stay in touch and, you know, meeting my grandmother. And all of that was like really emotional because you build these things up in your head, right? Of what it's going to be like to reconnect with these people that you have only seen in photographs, you know, these expectations that people had put on me, you know, can you speak Indian? What do Indians think? And like all of this nonsense. And I mean, I knew as much about Indians as anybody else from watching Little House on the Prairie, right? Like we're talking about the 70s, right? Like I had no idea. I didn't even know that there were native communities in Niagara, right? Like I had no idea. My mom thought she was protecting me because she had heard the same things that everybody else had heard about Native people, right? That were dangerous, that there's drug use, all these other things. And so she thought she was protecting me. She wasn't trying to be harmful. She was trying to protect me. So going home was really emotional. And I went down to the water often just to at least look at the reserve. You know, can I at least see it from here? And I don't know. I stacked stones. Like people do that, right? Like now we know better because they're salamanders and it releases sediments into the water and stuff. And so now hopefully we know better than to do those things. But I wanted to leave some permanent record of myself, you know, like Patty was here, you know, some kind of monument or memorial to the fact that I had been there. And when I put my hands in the water, the only way I can describe it is it felt electric, and that doesn't even really feel right. But when I say that, other people who have had similar experiences say that like you say, Sarah, that that resonated with them, that they also had that same kind of electric, but not really electric feeling. And I felt known. I felt remembered. I felt like I didn't need to leave some kind of permanent record, that some kind of permanent memory of me already existed. And now I live in Niagara, right? I mean, I've always lived in the Niagara region, which is kind of like the other end of that Great Lakes system, right? So the watershed of Lac Seul drains down. I mean, it's all Lake Muskegon, dotted with swamps and lakes and stuff. And that drains down into Lake Nipigon and Lake Superior, which of course comes through and down the Niagara River, like right past Chippewa where I live. And so that keeps me connected to that place, but I'm also in the land of the Mississauga Anishinaabe. Right? So the Ojibwe, the Anishinaabe people, like we're like this huge, huge group. But the Ojibwe Anishinaabe are not the same. It's kind of like New Yorkers aren't the same as people from New Mexico, right? Y'all are American, but you're different. You're not quite the same. So the Ojibwe and the Mississauga Anishinaabe, we're not exactly the same. So we're kind of like cousins. We're all Anishinaabe people, but the Ojibwe, we're like the Northern Bush Indians. So I'm very aware that even though I'm still in Anishinaabe territory, I'm still in diaspora. I'm still far from home. And so I think about that a lot, that the land knew me, remembered me. Was it telling stories about me to the land down here where I was being raised? Was the land here telling stories that made its way back? Like, I learned about the life cycle of water and how it travels in school, right? So, I don't know, it just made me think about my connection to place and to the people who emerged from those places. And I often called it being homesick for a place I had never been. Because at some level, I lived there until I was probably about 18 months old. So at some level, your brain is forming connections, right? Maybe not memories, but connections. You know, so I don't know. I feel connected to that place. And I go home, I want to say as much as I can. Every few years I go home. I've probably been home, I don't know, half a dozen times maybe since then. That first time was just really, there was all kinds of stuff going on that first time, right? I highly recommend going home to people, like if you can. I highly recommend it. Just go to that place where your people emerged. See the things your ancestors saw. You know, if you can. You know, my aunt went home to Ukraine, you know, my maternal side of the family. And she said, yeah, it was extraordinary. It was extraordinary to be in that place.
You know, just a little bit of my story. When I met, you know, the elder, Cree elder Stan McKay in New York City, oh, I don't know how many years ago, some 15 years ago, a long time ago. And I was sort of inappropriately telling him some of my story and saying, you know, asking him for help. He said that same thing to me, Patty. He said, you need to go to the land of your grandmother and you don't need to look for relatives or anything. Just go connect with the land and specifically with the water. And just a very profound part of my story to go do ceremony there in the beginning of trying to, you know, to find my people on behalf of my son who grew up also as part of a diaspora. And as I did without connection. So anyway, I was just so moved by your description and I thank you for sharing so genuinely with us here. And I'm wondering how that initial connection with the water that you're talking about has impacted the way you see the world or the way that you see, I guess the spirit of life in the water and the land itself.
We tend, I think, you know, in the Western world, we tend to think of water as a barrier, you know, as an obstacle, right? Like we talk about, you know, the oceans separating continents. Pacifica people would argue with that, right? I mean, the water for them is mother. You know, Tanya Tagak on, Twitter, we were talking, it's kind of processing through some things in the book. And she said, too, water is also mother. And, so like I said, when I was thinking about my hands being in the water, that water travels and carries memory. And I think of my friend Carrie, who I also wrote about in the book, being from, the African diaspora, from the Caribbean and then back to England and then over to Canada. Crisscrossing that, her history, crisscrossing that ocean. And it's not a barrier. It's itself a mode of transportation and a way of carrying. And we know this because we know that the desert, the sand from the Sahara Desert comes over the ocean and, and winds up over here. So we know that the ocean and the waterways carry us. And carry them. And I try not to be, I always laugh that, try to say that I'm like the least mystical Indian you'll ever meet, which isn't true. But I'm just, I always want to push back on that, that notion of like the mystical woo-woo Indian. But these things do have agency. They do have a life and their own relationship with the creator. And they do carry knowledge. Like, what memories does that water hold of all of us that it then shares with other beings? And I know that life cycle of water. We drink water, we release it back into the world, and it just keeps cycling around. It's not new.
Everywhere we look, we see signs that all is not right with our Earth. Extreme temperatures and weather patterns wreak havoc. Pollutants sour soils, waterways, and our very bodies, and fires and floods ravage land and communities. We believe climate change is just a symptom of a larger ecological crisis. If we want change, we must realize that the solutions to the problems we face can't come through the same systems that created those problems in the first place.
Ecological justice requires that we challenge our assumptions about creation and our relationship to it. It requires decolonization. We must turn to the leadership of Indigenous communities who struggle for all life as land and water protectors. And we are calling on people of faith to join them.
We believe this so strongly, we wrote a book about it. It's called So That We and Our Children May Live: Following Jesus and Confronting the Climate Crisis, and it's published by Herald Press.
This book offers hope for a better future alongside concrete actions for joining with Indigenous peoples to protect life and negotiate with decision makers for sustainable change that follows Jesus. In these pages, we invite you with us to confront climate change and choose life for our children and the future of our planet.
We invite you to buy our book and join the conversation. Thank you. Oh, this is already such a rich conversation. And, Sarah, you were the one who I was able to go back to Switzerland, the land of my ancestors, and Sarah was able to give me some counsel before I went. I love the way you talk about the primacy of land in your book, and in your this chapter you wrote called The Land, Our Ancestor, you say, and I thought this was very, I thought this was a really key insight for our listeners. You say, any social justice action that disconnects inequity from access to land can just reinforce settler colonialism. Can you unpack that for our listeners?
Yeah. So, I mean, W.E. Du Bois talked about this as well, right? I mean, that's, I cite him in the book because he was operating as, that you need to have access to land, And what's wild to me is that colonial governments know that. Right? Capitalist systems know that access to land equals stability, equals wealth, or otherwise they wouldn't want it. They wouldn't be trying to accumulate it and dispossess us from it. They would leave us alone on it if they didn't think it mattered. So they know it matters. but they tell us that it doesn't. They tell us that we can be disconnected from it and just move us around, you know, according to however, you know, however, wherever they need us to be. And so when our systems of justice get disconnected from land, get disconnected from Indigenous ideas about land, which isn't about who owns it and where the boundaries are, and that this is ours and that's yours, and now we've got a border that we have to defend, you know, borders are inherently violent because now you have to defend them. And resources move back and forth across borders. The water doesn't care. You know, the Columbia River flow in the U.S., the actions that people take for farming and all of that in the Columbia River impoverishes Mexico because it reduces the amount of water flowing into Mexico. So these waters travel across borders all the time, and animals travel across borders. And when you disconnect people from the land, that in itself is a profound injustice that leads to environmental racism. Of, you know, where do you put toxic waste? Where do you put garbage dumps? Where do you put highways? If people can just be moved around like chess pieces with no regard for their relationship to land, then we become deeply impoverished in our social justice movements. And all we're worried about is getting access to the colonial system, which is what so much inclusive work is about. It's about getting access to the colonial system. Then all we're doing is reinforcing that colonial system that disconnects us from land and turns it into a commodity. And commodities wear out. And what do we do when there's not enough? Eventually, we're going to run out of planet. You guys talked about that in your book. The world is on fire, like right now, literally. The sun used to do forest firefighting. And he'd talked about, he's talked as an Anishinaabe person. He also understands pyro epistemology, which is something that Paulette Steves talks about, you know, kind of the use of fire in agricultural settings and, you know, and in shaping the land, because we do shape the land. We shape the land and the land shapes us back. But he's also talked about fire going through a clear cut and the intensity of that fire and kind of the moonscape that's left behind. And so that's what happens when we disconnect our social justice movements from the land. Even if we're being all environmentally and ecologically aware, if we're not including Indigenous people and people's relationship with land, then that's also a disconnection, right? That's what they did with the national park system. They came to Yosemite and was like, oh, look how great it is. Let's take the Indigenous people out. And pretty soon it looked like a garbage pile because nobody was there taking care of it.
Yeah, so you talk about how that kind of fire, the hot burning fire, it leaves, you know, the land so that it, the way you put it is it cuts your feet, you know, it cuts your feet. So it's decimated to a point where it's harmful to be there. And I appreciated that. I also just, your comment that you just made me think that there are some of us in the coalition who were, you know, this is kind of the structures nerds, those of us that work on laws and policies. In fact, my friend Tim Nafziger is the one that comes to mind. We often say it's kind of like a sub little slogan we say to ourselves, which is we want justice, not access. We don't need access. I don't need just access. That's not helpful to me. I mean, you said it in a much more articulate way that just accessing colonial systems is not going to get us where we need to go. We need justice. You know, I mean, just having a seat at the table is meaningless if justice is not our goal.
Right. Yeah. If we're not there to transform the system, to make the system more just and equitable, it's like I have access to provincial parks. I can go, I can pay my fee. I can argue with them about how this is my traditional land and I shouldn't have to pay to be on it. But that's just access. And who has access? Not everybody has access. And they're still the gatekeepers of under what circumstances we have access.
Right.
Well, you said that I love this paragraph on page 131 in your book. It was in that same The Land, Our Ancestor. You know, you talk about the land back movement, which, of course, has existed for hundreds and hundreds of years, even before it was called the land back movement. But you say that Like often settlers and migrants and the forcibly displanted get worried when Native people start talking about land back because they just assume it's going to mean evictions, relocations, and elimination. And you said in some places that might be true. Like it might mean that people do sometimes give up property. But you also said that even though although we are often, and I think reasonably, looking for change in ownership, at its core, land back means profoundly changing our relationship with land. And I just really wrote a big amen in my margins. So I just want to thank you for that. Those many, many insights just about this. So thank you.
Yeah. I mean, everybody talks about land back and they get really worried that we're just going to do to them what the colonial governments did to us. Right. And I think, nobody gets two houses until everybody's got one. There's no reason for people to have cottages and second homes and all of these other things that just serve to displace people. But for the most part, what do you care who you pay your taxes to? If I pay my taxes to the region of Niagara or the Mississaugas of the Credit, as long as I'm getting my water delivered and these other things happening, what do I care who I pay my taxes to? And I mean, a friend of mine was talking about this with an Indigenous friend because a lot of people wrestle with that. Should I give my home? Should I turn over my land? I live near a reserve. Should I turn over my land? And that change in ownership is possible. All reservation land is actually owned by the federal government anyway. And so you're actually giving your land to the federal government. But what if you just shared it? What if you just shared it with us? What if, and I just had this conversation this morning with a pastor friend, what if you went to the local, for here, it would be Mississaugas of the Credit. What if you asked them about a variance for some land use that you want to do with your property before you went to the city? What if you went to them to say, we want to expand our parking lot, or we want to take down these trees, or we want to do the whatever. Could you, give us some insight into how this may impact things? And then if they say, your plan is really ecologically sound, but why don't you do this or that? And then take that to the city. Go to the tribe first. Or if you can't give it back because it's you actually don't own it, you're leasing it as a business. Well, what if as a mental exercise you thought about, what if my leaseholder was the local nation? How would that shift my relationship with them? What would I do as a church or as a business to avoid being evicted? And then allow that to change your policies, allow that to change the way that you do business. And I mean, businesses could really argue, if you want to think about land back, one thing they could really do is argue for livable rent, because we live in cities too, and cities are also Indigenous land. So what they should be arguing for accessible rent, affordable rent for people, so that people can live and not be completely pushed out onto the streets. That could be a form of land back, making, back to the accessibility piece. We should all have a place to live, and that's something that anybody can work towards.
Around the globe, dreams ignite communities, but for many in the global south, opportunities are limited. For 70 plus years, MIDA has sparked lasting change in resilient communities worldwide through sustainable development, providing entrepreneurs with access to training, mentorship, and the resources they need to build stronger businesses. Join us. Together, let's pave the way for a just and equitable world where everyone thrives, because every dream deserves a chance. Visit givesolutions.org today.
I want to talk for a minute about an article you wrote for Sojourners last year in 2022. The name of the article is "Why Was Noah Silent at the End of the World?" We really love that title, Sherry and me, and find it especially relevant in the current moment. In the article, you note that Noah does not advocate for the survival of life on earth by arguing with God against the calamity of the flood. So I'm going to read an excerpt, if that's okay with you. Here's an excerpt from that article. Most of us church people don't argue with God. We don't argue with our theology. We don't argue with our teachers. Not for the sake of others, at least. We'll argue because the pews are too hard or too soft or because we don't like the worship songs. We'll argue over any number of things that inconvenience us, but we don't argue about the things that convenience us. The Western church is too convinced of its status, of its chosenness, and so, like Noah, it preaches to the lost but does not argue about the pending judgment. This is a really powerful statement about the position of the Christian church. I wonder if you could talk about how you think this perspective might be relevant to climate change and ecological overshoot.
I had to really give that some thought because I will admit that that is not what was at the front of my brain when I was writing that article. I was thinking about the things that the early evangelists or the early, you know, the theologians or whatever, so in Doppelganger, which is Naomi Klein's new book, she notes this too. And, you know, she's talking about the things that they had said. King James called it a wonderful plague sent by Almighty God in his goodness and bounty towards us to send among the savages. And that's like King James of the King James Bible. 1634, John Winthrop, the first governor of Massachusetts Bay Colony, says, "For the natives of this part, God has so pursued them, they're swept away by smallpox. And, you know, God has cleared our title to this place." And so, like, there's, like, they documented all of this stuff, right? Like, nobody's even making this up. This is in their own journals, right? Because they thought that they had the absolute right and entitlement to this place. And, you know, the smallpox plagues and everything that ripped through indigenous communities was just seen as proof that God was on their side. And, you know, and so they took that entitlement. And I think the Christian church still feels that sense of entitlement, you know, like they are God's chosen, you know, they have superseded, you know, the Jews, because the Jews did everything wrong. And then God had to kind of start over again with the church. And, you know, and so now they're the new inheritors of God's promise, which gives that. And when you assume that position, and it's really interesting to me, because when I talk to Jewish people about being the chosen people, they see it in a very, I'm going to say, indigenous way of thinking. It's not a place of entitlement and power. It's a place of obligation and responsibility. We are God's chosen people. Therefore, we must be hospitable. Therefore, we must be a blessing to all peoples. You know, like the land was given to Israel, you know, like the way it was written in the text, you know, so that they could share it. There's all those admonitions, like, okay, the genocide is there too. And my Jewish friends actually wrestle with that. They don't just take that as proof of God's bounty. You know, they wrestle with that. But there's also commands to be generous and to caretake and, you know, to be kind to the alien among them. And, you know, to leave the gleanings of the, like, all of that stuff, it's all in there. And yet when the Christians came here, they didn't take any of that with them. And so then as I was thinking about your question and about who, you know, and about how that is relevant to climate change and ecological overshoot, that made me think of, you know, the fires and the overheating and the vast swaths of land that are going to be uninhabitable. You know, like Arizona, I don't know how much longer, how many more decades is Arizona going to be habitable, you know, with some of the ridiculous heat that they've had. You know, Pakistan, there's islands in the Pacific that are going to be underwater. And yet, because Christians, I don't know, like that rapture theology, that's what I grew up with in the 70s, right? You know, we're all, Jesus is coming back any minute now. And so the world doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if these things disappear. It doesn't matter if all of this stuff happens, because this world is fallen and broken anyway. And so who cares? God's going to replace it all anyway. And so instead of hearing creation groaning and weeping and all of those other things that are contained in those prophecies, in that literature, Christians hear it as, well, it's just going to burn anyway, so who cares? We're just going to take as much as we can, and we're going to be okay. We're going to be okay, whether it's rapture or heaven or whatever. We've got to get out of jail free card, and our home isn't this planet anyway. And
that's what struck me is the connection to Noah. That sounds so much like the Noah stance, like, hey, I'm just building my ark here and let it burn, baby.
Yes, preaching to the lost. Preaching to the lost. Sure, you can get your get out of jail free card too, But then if you don't want it, then I guess you're going to burn too. So sad, too bad. Instead of Abraham argued with God, Moses argued with both of them, knowing that it would cost them something. Abraham said, even though it might kill me, I'm still going to try. Moses knew that he was taking his life into his own hands. Still, I'm going to try. Noah's like, yeah, sure, I'll preach and they'll laugh at me, but whatever. And then I get to be in the boat and everything will be fine. But we've even got denominational leaders, even the Pope is saying, climate change is happening and it's really bad and we should live better. But where's he actually putting his muscle? Are any of them really putting their muscle into actually, they've collectively got a lot of power that they could leverage against these corporations that they're deeply invested in because their mission budgets or whatever are, held in all these various GICs and whatever, because it makes good financial sense.
So Patty, you're singing our song right now.
Well, you're the one to learn that from. they could really put some muscle, but they don't argue. They say these things. And the absurdity for me was when Prime Minister Trudeau marched in a climate rally. For me, that was exactly what all of these organizations are doing, denominations and otherwise. This is what they're doing. He protested himself. You're the Prime Minister of Canada. You can do something. What are you doing? What do you mean you're marching in a climate? What are you doing? You're protesting yourself? This is absurd. But this is what they do. They say these things. And then they don't actually put any muscle into it. And so they're making empty, hollow arguments. They're like, yeah. We'll preach to the lost, but then, whatever, who cares? And now we got these tech pros that are building spaceships and thinking that we're going to colonize Mars as if there's planets. Come on, what's wrong with you people?
Well, I also just think, Patty, the people that are defending the earth and the water, the people that are defending soil and they're the land protectors, the water protectors, are Indigenous people again and again and again are standing up and defending what we all need to live. And the question that I have again and again is, where is the church? Where is the church? I mean, if you truly believe that you are the institution with the moral prerogative, where are you? I'm just dying to know. That's just the question I have.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to two very fundamentally different ways of viewing this world. So we talked with Keolu Fox a couple of years ago on the podcast because another friend of mine had quoted him. And so what he said, he's talking about in specific about the Mauna and the protests around the telescope on the Mauna, but also about other Indigenous protests, as you've mentioned, protecting the land. And people like to talk about Indigenous people as being stewards of the land. And what he says is the land is our ancestor, which goes far beyond stewardship. And he says, I say this, he's a geneticist and a bioethicist. And so he says, when I say the land is my ancestor, that is a scientific statement. He's speaking as a geneticist because the land shapes our genome. It becomes, the land impacts us in ways that are heritable, heritable. I don't even know how to say that word. But anyway, it impacts our genome. And he says, the land is my ancestor. That is a scientific statement. And so when we protect the land, we're protecting a relative. When we protect water, we're protecting a relative. That's my grandma. That's my great grandmother. That's a relative that I am protecting. It's not just stewardship. Like, we don't steward our children. We care about our children. We raise our children. That keeps us at a little bit of a distance. That's still thingifying stuff, right? We take care of things, but he's saying, the Aina, the Aki in Anishinaabemowin, it's a relative. But Christian theology sees the world as a fallen place that's going to need to be replaced. And our home is in heaven. It's not even here. Our home is in heaven. And so there is no theological investment in this planet. And so for churches, the theological investment is in our hereafter elsewhere. The theological investment is not in this world, because we have been told that this world is fallen and broken and will be replaced by a new earth. And I think, listening to my Jewish friends, that's a theology we can argue with. That's a theology that we can, that we can take a lesson from Abraham and Moses on, and we can argue with that theology, because that theology doesn't take us anywhere good. I think there are other ways of reading those stories and understanding our relationship with a planet that feels emotion, that reacts with joy, withdraws in grief, that has its own relationship with the Creator. And if we understand the world in that way, and the Old Testament gives us lots of opportunity to do that, then that's a much different relationship. Because if we don't care about a planet that clearly has its own feelings and its own relationship, Leviticus has promised that the land will vomit us out. Right? If we don't take care of the land, then it will take care of itself. And that's where the wildfire for the Anishinaabe, it's, the seventh fire, and the wildfire is going to come through. And how are we going to prepare for that? Will it be a fire that results in wild blueberries and, wild strawberries and fresh grass? Or is it going to be that moonscape that my son describes? And so I think the possibility is there in the text. I think this theology of the world being broken and in need of replacing is a theology we can argue against. But I think that is why we're not seeing churches wholesale arguing in favor of ecological things, because our investment is elsewhere. Our world is not, our future is not on this home. And I think it is.
Sarah, you and I both really love this British theologian activist named Noel Moles. I think I'm saying his name correctly. But he gave a presentation at a Mennonite church conference I was at some years ago. Actually, Tim Nefziger, our Sarah's and my mutual friend, brought him there. And he said, he describes himself as a Christian animist. And he says, I do too. I love it also. And he said, you are not going to heaven. The biblical understanding of heaven is not of a separate place. It is of a renewed and transformed earth that is actually living according to a right relationship. And I just loved it. He was like, you are not going to heaven.
Well, I also want to just point out that that is that theology that we believe is the Christian theology is not the Christian theology with a capital the. It is a place and time, and it's grounded in capitalism. And I've spoken about that before, and I won't get tedious about it now. But I think when we talk about Christianity with a capital C, most of us think about 20th century North American Christianity, which is a very strange, very specific, context-bound system of thought. And so... yeah, so I'm with you 100%. And here's what I say: watch out, Trudeau. I'm voting Patty next time. Of course, I can't vote Canadian election, but I would Patty for prime minister.
Oh, Lord, don't wish that on me.
You're so good to me. She'll do more than March.
I just remember watching him protest himself, and I was like, what is wrong with you? Well, it was like, you know, when the Black Lives Matter protests were sweeping the U.S. and Nancy Pelosi in Congress got down and knelt, I was like, why are you protesting yourselves? Don't you actually have the power to do something about this? What are you doing? It's just so absurd.
That should become like, I don't even do memes, but that should become like a meme, like, you know, like on Instagram, like, here's another politician protesting themselves again.
Yeah.
So, what are you talking about? Self-indigenizing? This would be self-protest.
Yeah. It's just so absurd, but I don't know. To them, I don't know if it makes sense to them. I don't know. A pastor, a friend of mine, actually gave a sermon one time that blew my mind, where he said what your friend said, that this idea that we're going to live in heaven and leave earth behind is not even in the Bible. Like, he says, I don't even know where it came from. And I sat there in church, I was in my 30s, and I was like, what are you talking about? I'd heard that my entire life, and you're telling me that this isn't even in the Bible?
Didn't you read The Late Great Planet Earth, which is what all our theology is based on? Do you remember that from the 70s?
Yeah. Okay, so Deep in the Night, I still watch that periodically. I call it, like, I don't know if it's like, you know, trauma nostalgia or what it is, but I still watch Deep in the Night. There's actually four of them.
Oh, Patty, I'm dying to see Thief in the Night. It completely traumatized me as a child.
Right? Yes.
And I feel like I need to rewatch it. And I don't know what, like maybe like hum and rock as I do it or something.
There's four of them in this series. Thief in the Night, Distant Thunder. See, now I'm revealing myself. I watch these. I just like self-traumatize. But yeah, it's just.
You want to hear something worse? I actually forced my son. I forced my son to watch the trailer. I was like, come on, you need to see what this is all about. You've got to see what I went through as a child.
Mother's so weird. Why she freaks out when Christians aren't where they're supposed to be.
X-Files and Like a Thief in the Night and Supernatural. I have my viewing list for the next, you know, 2 weeks.
What an amazing mashup that is. X-Files and Supernatural, they're also apocalyptic stories. Right? Like X-Files deals with a pending alien apocalypse. You know, that the aliens are going to destroy the world. And Supernatural also deals with an impending apocalypse. So actually, those would be a really interesting mashup. Okay, I'm going to have to write an essay about that.
For our listeners, when we first were greeting Patty before we started recording, we were talking about how Patty and I are both big X-File fans. I certainly am a sci-fi viewer and reader for sure. So anyway, that's where this conversation comes from.
Thank you. I forgot that part was not recorded. So this could totally go on for a much longer period of time, and I would love it. It would then become our longest podcast ever, because we're just having so much fun. So I'm going to ask what I think is our last question. Who knows what's going to happen? But we really want to hear more about your foundation. And on your website, you write, Nicanagana means we are all related, something like that. And we are, but we are not always good relatives. And the history of the colonial West is one of taking rather than sharing. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about your Nicanagana Foundation, which is the foundation that you co-founded.
Yes. So, I mean, it started a number of years ago. I was fundraising on Twitter. I was going up to visit my son, who was living in Iqaluit at the time, which is on Baffin Island, right? So like super far north. And they needed sanitary supplies. So I fundraised on Twitter because I'm like, I can't fill a suitcase with sanitary supplies. That's expensive. And then some people were asking, they wanted to keep helping. And I got into a little Twitter spat with somebody. And I don't know, they were just like feeling really bad about being white. And so I said, and that's like, that's exhausting. Like, don't do that to people. So I said, look, if you feel so bad, why don't you pay some rent? And then I thought, oh, that's a really good idea. And so I jumped over to Patreon, created the Pay Your Rent fundraiser, where basically just people gave me money and then I gave it to Native people. I just kind of turned around and, you know, gave it to Native people that are doing work in their communities. And then a few years after that, that became the nonprofit foundation, along with journalist Nora Loretto and Blackfoot activist Terrell Tailfeathers. And we've got a couple of other board members now as well. So it's the Nicanagana Foundation, payyourrent.ca. We take American money as well. And we also support American Indigenous people. We can operate all across North America. And that's all we do. We take money from guilt-ridden settlers that, you know, that feel bad and kind of helpless about living on Indigenous land. And then we turn around and we give it to Indigenous people. And we have two streams. So we meet people's material needs, often helping with their literal rent, buying groceries. We help paying. I just helped somebody with travel to get to a funeral, because there really aren't any programs that help with that kind of funding. We're often the place of last resort for people where they've exhausted all other resources, and then we're kind of their last stop. We do ask them to provide us with an advocate, somebody, because we're not just crisis response, so we want to make sure that they're supported over a longer period of time. And then the other stream supports provides like regular monthly amounts to Indigenous organizers that are doing everything from culture camps to beating circles to land and water back actions, you know, kind of ongoing work. So it's really those two streams. We move about $10,000 a month, and it really does go like it comes in, and then in probably in the space of about a week, it's all gone. We have no overhead because it's a volunteer board. So we spend like $150 a year on our website. I think that's our really only expenditure other than, you know, banking fees. But yeah, it's been really exciting. And we're looking at ways to kind of mobilize our donors to get more involved with actions in their area, to people that we could possibly connect them with. Because we do want it to be more than just donating money, right? It's about building relationships. And we're also, you know, kind of thinking about getting involved with the Debt Collective, which is an organization in the U.S. That's to get our recipients kind of involved in more collective action. Because it's not enough to just, you know, pay your rent and help some other people. We got to do something about these systems that are creating the need in the first place. And so that's kind of the next step that the organization is looking towards. But yeah, I mean, at the bare minimum, we're doing community building work and making sure that people survive to live in those communities. So yeah, that's the foundation. And I am super proud of my board and the work that we do. And it's really exciting to be part of kind of reallocating that money to people. So I'm really proud of that work, more so, I think, than anything else I do.
You know, I just listened to a podcast with, I think, a woman who might be an organizer for the Debt Collective, which I had never heard of before. I think her name's Astra Taylor. Yes. But
yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Is amazing.
I met her in Chicago. I didn't even know who she was. My son knew who she was, and he had come to this conference with me. So it's Socialism Conference in Chicago. And then we just randomly wound up talking with her about the foundation and could we possibly do some work together and get Debt Collective active in Canada. And she has a really profound way of looking at debt, because individually debt is very paralyzing, but collectively it becomes leverage. It becomes a source of power that people can use to change the world, to achieve some justice in the world. And it's that way, whether we're talking about land or whether we're talking about ecological system, individually, it's really hard. And our society deliberately atomizes us in this way to make it really hard, because corporations are very well organized. They talk to each other all the time. And this is why I'm pro-labor, because you don't think management meets regularly? Of course they do. Social labor. Workers should also be meeting regularly. Management is organized. So should workers be. You know,
that's why golfing was invented, for management to talk to each other. I'm just joking.
but collectively, we can really do stuff. So we need to, everything is better together.
Mm-hmm. So we have so much in common. I have a suggestion, which is let's be friends. This is just, okay. It's been so great to spend this hour with you. And I want to thank you for being willing to share so genuinely and authentically with us and to talk about these issues. And I'm so excited to hear about your foundation, which I hadn't heard of before, Nkagana and the Nkagana Foundation. So I'm going to say it again, the Nkagana Foundation, for our listeners to check it out. And I look forward to learning how we can support you too in the coalition to dismantle the doctrine of discovery. And thank you so much for being here with us. It's just been a delight.
This has been a really enjoyable conversation. Thank you so much for having me.
And listeners, please read Becoming Kin. It's a life-changing book. Check it out.
And all of the information on all of the book and your website, Patty, and the foundation's website, I'm going to put in the show notes. So check those out too.
Beautiful. Thank you so much.
This podcast is hosted by us, co-produced by the DD of D Coalition and Anabaptist World.
The opinions expressed here are ours, however, and do not reflect official positions of Anabaptist World.
For more information, go to anabaptistworld.org and dofdmeno.org.
Our theme music is by Micah Peplow and Shannon Kaler. Thank you.